I was that random kid who was going around to all the neighbors and saying, do you have any old broken electronics? Can I take it apart? My parents, both accountants, incredibly supportive, but they had no idea what I was doing. And they basically, just as long as I was following my curiosity, they would support me. I did all these things that, unfortunately, were terrifying for them, such as making smoke bombs that accidentally went off in the house, and my mom thought the whole house was on fire, to all kinds of just weird things, you know, making Tesla coils and rail guns and chemistry stuff, and I was that weird kid. Luckily, it all worked out.
I'm fairly sure that saying it all worked out for Steve Keating is the understatement of the 21st century. Steve survived his smoke bombs, homemade disasters, and, as you'll hear, far more than that, to end up at the MIT Media Labs. It's a place that collects geniuses in mathematics, music, art, film, science, biotech, puts them all under one roof, and then basically lets them do a deep dive into their curiosity. They bounce around the boundaries, they disrupt technology, and today we're going to tell you about one of the coolest inventions he pioneered there.
So it can do 3D printing, it could do milling, it could do sensing, it could do excavation.
Now, I know a lot of you listening might think, 3D printing? That's not that new. There is some insane stuff that's going on out there. There's some 3D printed beaks for eagles injured in the wild, 3D printed sushi that you can actually eat, 3D printed custom clothes. But what if I told you that Steve imagined a giant robot that could 3D print an entire building? By itself, anywhere. And not only that, but it could figure out how to supply its own materials. So you don't have to feed it any filament or plastic or any other materials. And what if I told you that's only the second coolest thing he's ever done? I'm Mick Ebling, and this is Not Impossible. This is a podcast about inventions that tackle seemingly insurmountable problems and the creative minds behind them. The people who ignored it when someone said their idea would never work, and they went ahead and did it anyway and succeeded. And in doing so, just happened to change the world. This podcast is brought to you by Avnet, a company dedicated to helping creators of all types find whatever they need to get their idea to product, and then their product to market anywhere in the world. So when Stephen Keating was 5, he was playing around with a Commodore 64 computer in his closet, and he came across the very first video tour of the MIT Media Lab. And let's just say, he knew it was the place for him.
My first experience walking into the Media Lab, it felt like I was in Willy Wonka's chocolate factory. There's this glass elevator, and as you go up this elevator, you see robots, you see furniture that's moving, you see all of these incredible scientific and interesting things as you're riding up this glass elevator. I was in the Mediated Matter Group, which is led by Professor Neri Oxman, and she is this amazing, incredible architect, designer, and Neri's work covers this incredible span of taking biological ideas and combining it with design and fabrication.
And if the name Neri Oxman rings a bell, it might be because you've seen her on the cover of some of the supermarket tabloids in some kind of romantic link with Brad Pitt. But that's not the focus here. The reason that you should know her and the rest of her team is because they're doing amazing, amazing, brilliant stuff. Professor Oxman is a genuine radical thinker and architect who is inspired by the perfect designs found in nature. Her work is in MoMA and so many other cool places. Have you ever seen those death masks that Bjork wears in concert? Yep, those were designed and 3D printed from her own facial features by Professor Oxman. Then you get Neri and Steve together. And these are people who, in their spare time, will, I don't know, create a vest with live cells actually 3D printed into the fabric and biologically engineered so that it might, for example, turn pink when you walk into a room to warn you of a carbon monoxide imbalance. Just kind of crazy, right? But when Steve joined Professor Oxman's lab, they started talking about creating a robot to go out on its own and 3D print entire buildings. That seems like something completely impossible, even for them.
You've got this brilliant idea called the Digital Construction Platform, DCP. Walk us through, what DCP is, where the idea come from, just walk us through it.
So coming into the project, we had this idea of, can we actually scale fabrication using robotic systems based on biological principles? So, for example, instead of our current process of manufacturing buildings, which is basically done by mass manufacturing of standard components that we ship to a site, what if we can actually have a self-sustaining system? So kind of like a tree grows with its environment in mind. So it's growing towards the light, it's taking in environmental variables. And one of the amazing things about a tree is it's self-sufficient. So it gathers almost all of its materials from the air, right? So it's pulling carbon dioxide and other materials from the air to grow, and it's getting its own energy from the sun. Could we do the same thing with construction? So actually have a totally autonomous system that drives out on site, scans the environment, designs the system based on the environmental variables, and actually gets its own material. So gathers, say, dirt, gathers, say, ice or other materials, and fabricates it on site.
Okay, that's just mind-boggling.
We're just scratching the surface of what's possible. What if buildings in the future could be dynamic? So you could actually have systems that can change over time. Or what if you can use these robotic systems autonomously to create structures in dangerous environments? For example, what if you wanted to send this to the moon or to Mars, and it could actually use materials that it finds on the moon or Mars to make structures?
Okay, so think about that. Not only was this robot going to go off by itself, maybe someplace dangerous, someplace humans couldn't go or shouldn't go, it was going to go there, find what it needs, and then use those materials to make buildings. Buildings that would be perfect for that particular environment. And not only was this robot going to be able to do this here, but on Mars? Crazy, right? Maybe crazy, but Steve decided, not impossible. So for his PhD project, Steve actually builds this robot.
To give listeners an idea of what the platform looks like, the DCP, it's actually an 8,000-pound robot on tank tracks. So just like a tank moves around, it's got those tracks so that can go on rough terrain, and it's got a 50-foot robot arm. So it actually has a hydraulic arm that's linked to a smaller robot arm on the end and uses it like a compound arm system. So it's just like your finger on the tip of your arm. So if you're writing a letter, your fingers are controlling the pen and allowing you to write letters, but your shoulder is making the bigger movements that let you cover the page. And so that's what we've done for our system. We call it a compound arm system, and it's the first large-scale mobile platform. And we actually 3D printed a 50-foot dome structure in under 14 hours as part of the final work of my PhD.
So, all right, just so everyone understands, what Steve just said is that he's basically created a giant robot arm on tank tracks that 3D printed a 50-foot dome. I'll pause there for a second and let that one sink in.
And while you're pondering that, ponder this. Steve says the possibilities for this new technology are limitless. And I'm not talking about Mars. I'm talking about the construction project going on right around the corner, right now.
Well, there's huge, huge potentials in so many different areas. For example, construction is one of the most dangerous industries we have today in terms of human safety. So we can, by putting in robotic and autonomous processes, we can reduce human risk. We can improve safety of construction sites. The possibilities for new functionalities are huge. And then you can also imagine there's massive benefits for time, material usage, and cost bases.
There's a lot of fear of people talking about the robots are taking over the world, the robots are taking over the world. How do you play that into the world that you're looking at now?
Every technology will change how we do things, right? And people always worry, we get this question sometimes of, aren't you worried it's going to reduce human jobs? But no, it just changes jobs. Instead of workers having very dangerous conditions on site, it makes new jobs. For example, instead of them, you know, manually putting things together, they can be at a computer and controlling the robotic system. It allows all of these new possibilities for saving cost, for reducing danger, and for producing new functionalities.
Talk a little bit about that, I guess, the efficiency that this creates, especially on drawing off of things that are around it. Because I think that's really the novel concept. When I first started researching about this, I anticipated this thing that was just spitting out concrete or spitting out metal. But what you've now shared is this could spit out anything and everything around.
For us, like you said, one of the big factors was this flexibility of control to use environmental properties in part of the design. So, for example, in the large dome that we printed, it's about 50 feet in diameter. The radial reach of the arm is around 30 feet or so. So we printed by rotating in place about a 50-foot dome. So right now, for example, you've got your printer at home, right? You're printing out a piece of paper, but you're limited to printing out a letter-sized piece of paper because that's the size of the printer. What we're talking about is if we make a mobile printer or a mobile construction platform, it can drive around and have a limitless scale. And that's what we've done here with the system. And it's actually got a flexible solar panel. So in the future, it could actually be completely autonomous, even for power, by laying out a flexible solar panel and charging from the sun and then continuing to fabricate.
That's amazing.
So this notion is that we really wanted to make it, you could send this, I'm from Canada, so send it up to the Arctic. And we actually did some small-scale printing tests using ice. So this idea of if you have snow all around you, say you're in the Arctic, you've got snow and ice all around you, you've got solar energy powering the digital construction platform. It can gather ice and snow, melt it using the energy from the sun, and then reprint it and basically create giant structures out of ice.
What you're describing is a self-contained Robinson Crusoe machine, and the things that you've proven already in their very pragmatic execution as well as your conceptual execution. I don't think you have to think, dude, this isn't teleportation. You can see very pragmatically that this is a natural extension, and this is a question of scale.
Exactly.
Okay. So we're going to leave that Robinson Crusoe machine aside for a second, just as Steve had to in 2014, because I told you it was only the second coolest thing he ever did. So if that story didn't bend your mind, this one definitely will. In 2014, Steve Keating had to refocus his superpowers on solving a very personal crisis.
In college, if you go up to the bulletin boards, there's lots of posters looking for study participants. And I would often do them because I was just curious and it was interesting to help science and fun to do. And one in 2007 was a brain study. And I volunteered because I always wanted to see my brain. So I went in and I was looking at pictures of spiders and things like that while they were doing an MRI study. So they were scanning my brain and it was for research. And so I asked afterwards, I said, oh, could I have a copy of the data? And they were like, oh, sure. And here's your picture. I actually made my Facebook profile picture at the time a picture of my MRI'd brain because I was like, this is so cool. I'm seeing my brain and I'm helping science at the same time. And they said, oh, by the way, there's a small abnormality here in your MRI scan. You might want to get it checked out. So I had the scan originally in 2007. I got it rescanned in 2010. No changes. The kind of statement was, oh, you're all good. So I said, great. Go on with the rest of our life. Go to MIT. And I start to smell a faint vinegar smell for a few seconds a day. And after about the second or third time, I totally just thought it was just vinegar in the air. It happened late at night. And I went out to the kitchen and none of my roommates were up or cooking. And I went back and I thought, that's so weird. And I remembered I had that brain abnormality and I went back to the data from 7 years prior. This is 2014. Went back to the scan and was Googling around and realized, holy crap, the abnormality, it's right near where the olfactory center of the brain is. That's the smell part of the brain. And I thought I was just being, you know, overreacting, but I thought, you know what? I'm going to go back to the doctors. I'm going to ask them if this is an issue. they booked the scan for a month later because they weren't concerned at all. So actually in that month's time, the smells actually had stopped. And so I'm going into that scan thinking I'm a total idiot. And I'm on my way out of the room from the scan, and the technician stops me and goes, you cannot leave. You have a massive brain tumor.
So Steve Keating has just had the worst possible diagnosis that he could imagine. Brain cancer. And yet, he was about to turn that terrible moment into an idea that could create a revolution in medical treatment for all of us. We'll tell you how that happened after the break. This is a podcast dedicated to technology for the sake of humanity. But it's also about the people behind that technology. If that's you, Avnet can help, no matter what you build. Why? Because they are the first company ever to offer true end-to-end solutions for product development in-house. That way, creators in any corner of the world can take an idea from prototype all the way through mass production. Are you a startup, an established OEM? Do you need help designing your product or organizing your workflow or getting stuff to market? Avnet's got your back. Your world is one that's always changing, and that's why Avnet is here to help you reach further. And we want to give a special shout out to Avnet's engineering communities, Hackster and Element 14, who help creators vet and invent the technology of tomorrow. Want to do more than just listen to this podcast? Maybe something like taking on the next Not Impossible challenge? Go to podcastnotimpossible.com to find info for you and for anyone who wants to take their project one step further. So picking back up, Steve Keating has just gone in for a brain scan that he thought was just a precaution and found out that he had a brain tumor the size of your fist. For most people, that would just be debilitating emotionally, physically, spiritually. But as it should be clear by now, Steve Keating is not most people.
I truly believe if I was not at MIT, I wouldn't be here today because I had access to this incredible minds of MIT, these research geniuses and scientists who I could talk to about my mutation. And we actually ended up sending out all of my medical data, which was online, to different neurologists and different neuro-oncologists around the U.S. asking, who is the best surgeon for this? What is the best approach? And 3 weeks later, I had a 10-hour awake brain surgery. And I again, wanted...
Awake.
Yeah.
Hang on. Just so I'm clear. You said a 10-hour awake brain surgery.
Yeah. So brain surgery is one of those weird things where there's not really pain receptors in the brain. And so you can actually have an awake brain surgery if it's beneficial. For example, my tumor was near the language center. So what they didn't want to do is cut out the wrong part of the brain and affect my ability to talk. So throughout the surgery, I was awake and talking as they were cutting out about 10% of my brain.
How's it going, man? 1 second. We're doing good. We have your brain exposed. We're actually measuring. There's some saline and also regular saline.
And for those of you with a strong stomach that want to see this, it's all online. So if you Google my name, you can see, and you can see me talking and asking how the doctors are doing and telling stories while they're literally cutting open my brain, which was a weird experience to watch afterwards.
Great. Talk to us again.
It's hard to hear him through the oxygen mask, but as he said, they wanted to keep him talking. So Steve's talking about how he met his girlfriend Wendy and stuff like that, while the surgical team removes pieces of his brain. That is pure Steve Keating. So the surgery went great, and afterwards, Steve started radiation therapy. And of course, Steve being Steve, he couldn't keep his curiosity out of the room with him.
So get this, I'm literally in the radiation room at the Massachusetts General Hospital. And this is where they do proton radiation. So they have a particle accelerator where they spin up protons and then they shoot those protons at the patient. And that goes in to the skull, into the brain, and causes mutations that can help with the cancer treatment. But it also makes you radioactive. And so being the huge geek that I am, I would actually take a Geiger counter to my head after the proton radiation, and I could detect I was actually radioactive for a few hours. But it wasn't a dangerous level of radioactivity. It was just a very small amount.
A small amount, unless, of course, you happen to get an invitation to meet President Obama.
When I got invited to the White House, it was on the very last day of my proton radiation. And as a Canadian, I'm standing in the foreign line to get in to the White House, and they have Geiger counters. And I'm standing there super excited to be done with proton radiation and going into the White House, and then I have this horrible realization that I might not get into the White House because I'm actually radioactive. But luckily, it all worked out. I was not at any dangerous level, and I went in and ended up serving on the Precision Medicine Task Force, working on policies for healthcare and patient data access, and it's been quite the interesting ride since.
An interesting ride indeed. Because Steve wasn't just satisfied with getting rid of the cancer, he wanted to get to the root of it, figure out what caused it. But that turned out to be very difficult. Maybe even more difficult than building a robot to construct houses on Mars.
I was collecting my own data, and it was incredibly useful for me to help make these decisions. But I was so surprised at how hard it was to do. For example, after the surgery, they cut out literally about 10% of my brain. If you were to make your hand into a fist, it's about that size of what they cut out of me. And so they asked, of course, would you want to donate that tumor to research? And of course, I said yes, because I want to help out science.
In order to get answers about the cause of his brain tumor, Steve wanted to have a peek at the information the research had turned up about his brain. You know, the one that he donated for scientific research? His brain? But the lawyers said,
no, because there's a lot of gray legal policies around data access for patients in the U.S., particularly for research data. The researchers at MIT could see my genetic data, but I could not. And it was my own brain tissue. The only way they said that the tumor could be accessed is by medical researchers. So I said, well, how do you become a medical researcher? And I was in the middle of my PhD at MIT, and so I actually switched and applied to med school. There's a joint Harvard-MIT med school program that I applied to, got into, and took a year of med school classes. I took a few different classes, including pathology, and at the end of that year, I could then apply through the pathology class for research access to my tumor. And it worked, and I got a very, very small chunk of my brain. I've got it here. I know you can't see this, but I'm holding it in my hand here. It's a little piece of my brain.
He's holding a little piece of his brain. So Steve then goes ahead and sends a sliver of his brain to be sequenced. And you know what he found? He traced his brain cancer back to a single point mutation. A G turned into an A. Random, unlucky. But as you can imagine, Steve is one of those lemons to lemonade kind of guys.
Because my background is in digital fabrication, of course, once I had a lot of the different type of medical data, I wanted to visualize it. And one of the things I looked at doing is 3D printing it. So I would get my MRI and CT scans, and I would actually 3D print the data so I could see how the skull part was cut out and they did the surgery. I could see how the CT scan shows the different structures inside the skull and the brain.
That's right. Steve actually 3D printed his own brain tumor. And that set a whole sequence of events in motion. He worked with researchers at MIT and others to develop a whole new method of 3D printing medical data. It's going to revolutionize how we visualize the body. Think of med students 3D printing their own bodies to dissect instead of cadavers. Now, we can devote a whole other podcast to this, but suffice it to say, it's all part of this mission that Steve has been on since his own diagnosis, to democratize medical data so other people can get the info and the tools to be part of their own medical decisions. And what he did with his own info, in addition to revolutionizing medicine, of course, is classic. Spoiler alert, this is a guy whose favorite holiday is April Fool's Day.
there's not that many benefits of having brain cancer, but one is that if you forget something, you can just say, well, it must have been in the 10% of my brain that got cut out. But also, yeah, I took and 3D printed my brain tumor into all kinds of weird things. So bottle openers and salt and pepper shakers. And for my family for Christmas, I gave them all brain tumor Christmas tree ornaments, which the look on my mom's face was one of shock and hilarity at the same time. And I posted all of those files online, and other people have now downloaded my brain tumor and actually printed it and sent me pictures. And so that's pretty fun to see the silver lining to that all.
Happy brain surgery, Steve.
One of my favorite TV shows is Modern Family, and one of my friends organized a video. She actually got a number of people that I admire to actually send me video notes sending their support.
Happy brain surgery, Steve!
Happy brain surgery to you! Happy brain surgery to you!
It was a huge surprise to me, and it's those types of things that, you know, I, as a scientist, I never would have thought could act as a treatment, but really the support itself is a powerful medicine.
Amen. And I guess one of the reasons I'm so touched and so inspired by that story, especially coming from a scientist, is that in my own work, collaboration, humans sharing with one another is usually, if not always, what makes the difference when you're trying to make what seems impossible not impossible. It happens to me again and again. In fact, it was a huge factor in my own 3D printing adventure. I had read an article in Time magazine by Alex Perry about a young boy named Daniel. He's caught in the middle of a civil war in Sudan. And one day he was out tending his family's goats and cows, and he heard a plane overhead. This was a Russian Antonov cargo plane. These things would come every single day, and they would bomb the people of the Nuba Mountains. And so he heard this plane, and he went and he hid behind a tree, and he wrapped his arms around it. The tree protected his body, but both of his arms were blown completely off. And in the article, I remember Daniel saying, "I saw blood. I looked and I saw my hands weren't there, and I couldn't even cry." I cried when I read about it. And then suddenly I remembered another article I had seen a couple months prior about a man in South Africa named Richard Van Ass. And he was this gruff, really passionate carpenter who was in Johannesburg, and he accidentally lost four fingers to a table saw accident. And it turned out this guy, who I ended up meeting, had one of the darkest senses of humor I'd ever come across. He said to me that after the accident, he was in so much pain, but he wouldn't take painkillers. He told me he barely slept, and the more pain he felt, the more ideas he got. And I remember him saying, "Sometimes you just have to chop off a couple fingers to start thinking." That was classic Richard Van Ass. What Richard was thinking about was how to use a 3D printer to make a new hand for himself, and one that didn't cost the $10,000 or some ridiculous amount that the hospital was quoting him. He wanted to make one that he could build for $500 or less, and that would work when he flexed his wrist. It would then cause the fingers to move, and they would move in a way so that he could grab things like a coffee cup or a hammer or a ball. In short, it was a hand that would let him be himself again. So we hatched this crazy plot. What if we could bring a 3D printer to Sudan and find that boy, Daniel, and then print an arm for him? And what if we taught the locals how to use that 3D printer and left it with them? And they could continue to print more arms for more boys and girls who lost arms in the war. And believe it or not, 2 months later, I was in Johannesburg in the home of Richard Van Ass. He invited me there to teach me how to print those robo hands, as he called them. And it wasn't just him. Hackers and makers from all over the world had gotten wind of our crazy scheme and started to print robo hand parts for us to bring along just in case the printers didn't work right when we got to Sudan. But they did work. We ended up finding Daniel. We printed a new arm for him. And in the middle of a war zone, in the middle of this 70,000 person refugee camp in Sudan, one boy, one beautiful, innocent boy whose only crime in life was hiding behind a tree that was too small when the bombs fell. That young boy picked up a spoon with a 3D printed hand that I made him. We gave him a bowl of granulated sugar because it was the lightest thing I could find. And he picked up a spoonful and ate it. And he cringed because it was so sweet. And everyone in the camp started applauding and laughing and crying because that moment was just that sweet too. When I think back upon that story now, the thing that stands out for me the most was how willing so many people were to help us. The companies that funded us, the hackers and makers around the country who jumped in to try to help, and especially Richard Van Oss, who inspired me and made me believe that I could do the impossible. Well, as it turns out, Richard Van Oss inspired a whole lot of people. One of them was a professor at the Rochester Institute of Technology, John Scholl. So John, and he admits this himself, was totally procrastinating one morning, drinking coffee and surfing the internet, when he came across a YouTube video about Richard and his 3D printed hand. And he has an idea, and he spends an hour making a digital map of the world and posts it under that video.
And I put a comment on the YouTube video saying, if you have a printer and you want to help, put a pin on this map. And if you know someone who needs a hand, put a pin on this map. And to my surprise, that evening, there were 7 pins on the map. 6 months later, there were 70 pins on the map.
And that was the birth of what John called Enable, an online volunteer community. And soon those numbers grew into thousands, people saying that they needed a 3D prosthetic hand, and people saying that they had 3D printers and could make them, all finding each other through this open source network. It was fantastic.
It's not all about 3D printers per se. It's enabled by internet communications, and it's a goodwill pay it forward network, which I think has demonstrated in the 5 years that there are probably tens or hundreds of thousands of high-tech, high-touch volunteers who are willing and able to do things in this kind of a loosely organized movement that are not being done by our traditional institutions, not being done by governments, not being done by NGOs, not being done by the institutional nonprofit sector.
And the Enable group, all these hackers and makers and dreamers and schemers, are taking the 3D printing of limbs to whole new levels. And that's what I love about these communities, these forward-thinking makers and rebels. They don't just invent something to solve one problem, they keep going with it. Like Steve's Robinson Crusoe machine, it's not just enough that it 3D printed an entire building, it needs to get better. It needs to work on its own. It needs to find its own materials. So, like, it could go into an erupting volcano and repair a fissure, or 3D print an entire refugee village in the wake of a tsunami.
Yeah, the concept around self-sufficiency is a much longer exploration, but has immense possibilities for remote locations, for extremely dangerous locations.
Steve Keating again.
For example, NASA is very interested, and we're in discussions with them around the notion of printing on other planets. Instead of having to carry all the weight of construction materials to the moon or Mars, what if you could send a self-sustaining system that can actually gather its own materials, that can make structures out of moon dust or out of Martian dust? What if you can use this in extreme environments, say Fukushima or disaster relief sites from hurricane damage, or extreme environments where it's dangerous for humans just because of say extreme temperatures, such as fabrication in the Arctic or Antarctic.
Where you're going with this, you can see the future. It's not a future that seems too science fiction. It seems science fiction, but it seems very possible. So I get that.
Well, we haven't sent it up to the Arctic for its year yet. But yes, the system we've shown it, with this work, that it can run off electricity and it can self-charge using photovoltaics, and it can actually gather local material and fabricate. Now, these are all early experimentations. I do want to stress that. We have not sent it yet to the Arctic for its 1 year of fabrication.
I appreciate the disclaimer. I appreciate the disclaimer. But what you're saying is for the future, because this is a forward-thinking show.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right? Is that I'm going to put you on the stand. Mr. Keating, can you please take the stand? So I just want to be clear that you have proven thus far in your early steps that conceptually, very, very, very feasibly, that should this robot be deployed someplace, that this robot could live alone.
Yes,
correct?
We have shown that, but I do want to emphasize this is just the beginning. What we have shown is a lot of very small-scale experiments of how different tools can be used, how welding can be used, how excavation of earth can be used, how ice can be 3D printed, how photovoltaic charging can be used. And we've shown an in-depth study of 3D printing a 50-foot hemispherical dome structure using construction-ready materials.
Steve is pretty confident about the future. I mean, here he is living with brain cancer, and he's like the most optimistic guy I've met in a very long time.
Yeah, so I'm doing very well. I got extremely lucky. Brain cancer is unfortunately one of those things that often does come back. So I will be monitored at least every year to see if it comes back. But so far, I'm doing well. It has not come back to our knowledge. And fingers crossed for the future.
Fingers crossed. He's so low-key about it all. But think about it. Here's a guy with a brain tumor, asked to be in a medical study, and his response is, heck yeah, I've always wanted to have my genes sequenced. He's the quintessential, not impossible hero. Steve Silverlining Keating. And before we let him go, there's this letter that Steve wrote to his family and friends before he went into surgery. It's about the things that he finds most important in life. I asked him to share the ending with you.
So here's the last three bullets. Perspective is everything, and switching shoes yields most powerful thoughts. Family and friends are what remain when the world blurs. And the next one was about open data. It was gather data as often as possible and share it with the world. It could save your life one day. Even just to have it yourself is important. And then the very last point of the email, I said, the world is a lovely, splendid, and fascinating place. But most of all, to me, it's beautifully curious. And that, to me, kind of emphasized how I felt about the whole thing. I was on a roller coaster ride that I didn't sign up for, but I was strapped in. I wasn't going to get out, so I thought, might as well enjoy the views.
So there you have it. For all its ups and downs, the horrors that he lived through, the triumphs behind him, the triumphs yet to be, Steve Keating has lived a life, as he said, of beautiful curiosity. So maybe we can all learn a little from Steve. We're all strapped in here together, right? We might as well enjoy the view. Thanks for listening to Not Impossible. Shout out to our sponsor, Avnet, a company that provides true end-to-end technology solutions to help people who make anything, anywhere in the world, reach further. Go check out their communities. Hackster, the world's fastest growing developer community for learning, programming, and building hardware. Element 14, the biggest designer engineer community on the planet. You can find links to their websites on ours, podcastnotimpossible.com. We're also posting links to Enable and to Steve Keating's website, where you can see all those crazy inventions and even watch his brain surgery. And don't worry, if you don't have 10 hours to watch his brain surgery, he's accelerated it to 2 minutes. Again, those links are on our website, podcastnotimpossible.com. Lydia Stroll produced this episode, edits and mixing by Lizzie Peabody. Our associate producer was Vicky Shirer, our development director, Aaron Sullivan, our director of partnerships, Joe Babarski. Special thanks to Steve Keating, John Scholl, Tor Myron, and Julian Leland for helping make this episode possible. And our executive producers are Phil Lerman and me. I'm Mick Ebling. Until next time, remember, put your goals out there. Think big. Think huge. Imagine. Just take the leap. The net will appear. It might be tough, it might be hard, but it's not impossible.